The Man in Line with Andy Wint.
Faster Mike, good afternoon. Welcome to Man in Line on Max Radio with the Infrastructure Minister, Russian MHK Michelle Haywood, on today. If you want to get in touch, text or WhatsApp on 166177, email studio at manxradio.com or call 661368. The DOI is huge. Vital aspects of the Isle of Man's life, of course. The Liverpool landing stage, bus van in, the airports, the harbours, looking after the roads, waste management, it's all there. Oh, and the proposed 20-mile-an-hour limit. So, loads to talk about today. Michelle Haywood, Faster Mike, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Last time we were on, we launched straight away into the Peel to Craigneish bus.
Yep.
What's the latest?
So I've seen the timetables through. The RTLC have approved the route, and Bus Vanin are just working with the drivers to staff up the route, and I'm hopeful that we'll have the first buses running by the end of the week.
Well, that's an absolute result. So congratulations on that. Let's get to the lines now. And I think we've got it's Chris with us, first of all, today. Hi, Chris. You're live with the Minister for Infrastructure.
Hello, Andy. Thank you very much. Hello, Michelle. If I could ask you just recently quoted that there was 85 accidents in the Douglas Oncombe area where you're proposing the 20 limits. In them 3.5 years, how many vehicle movements has there been? How many journeys has there been in them 3.5 years?
Okay.
So we can get a percentage of the accidents.
Okay,
please.
just pray see that again, because Michelle had an issue with the headphones. Give us that again.
Sorry, Andy. On Manx Radio, Michelle quoted that there's been 85 accidents in the last 3.5 years in the Douglas Oncombe area. What I'd like to know is how many vehicle journeys has there been in the same period, so we can get a percentage, so we can understand what percentage of vehicle movements to accidents.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Chris, for the question. I don't think I did quote it on Manx Radio. I think the information was given in an answer to one of the members of the House of Keys that had asked the question about what do we have in the way of accident statistics. I don't have the number of journey movements with me, but I can undertake to see if we know about that. But we don't have routine monitoring of traffic through all of the routes into Douglas every day, and I don't know that we'd be very accurate in our estimation of that. We do, of course, have speed recording data, which would record traffic volumes down various roads at various points. But I can ask the engineers and see if they can collate something. Not all of those roads are monitored at the same time, so you can get the effect where perhaps you've got roadworks in one area and people reroute and take different roads. So we might not capture absolutely accurate data. I think what the member was trying to elucidate was, you know, on those roads, how many accidents are happening. And because we obviously haven't decided on where the 20 miles an hour are going yet, whether that was a factor in deciding it. But we've been quite straight all the way along that this wasn't necessarily a decision that was taken based on data. It's not a decision taken to primarily cut accidents. There will be that effect almost certainly, because we know that from studies elsewhere, that where speed reduction has been introduced, the severity and the number of accidents does reduce. But this was a decision that was taken by Tynwald for a variety of reasons that were discussed, and you can go back and look on the Hansard for the debates in 2020 and 2023 to see what the reasons were that members gave for supporting this move.
Chris?
Okay. Yeah, in 2022 then, Michelle, on the document that I read, which you said was from Tynwald, that's fine, there was 29 accidents, and each year it's gradually decreased to this year, in 8 months, not a full year, there's been 8 accidents. If you do go to the 20 limits, which I'm dead against, but if you do go to the 20 limits and you find that the accident rate increases from the 8 this year so far, will you go back to the 30 limit?
I think the thing to be careful of here, Chris, with all due respect, is that because our number of accidents are fairly low, it's not possible to say, you know, we can say there's a trend over time, and certainly we spend a lot of time as with our highways network engineers looking at where accidents are occurring and engineering the road to reduce the possibility of accidents there. But the numbers are really, really variable year on year. So we can have a really good year because there's no frosty, icy days, for example. And we can all recall Bray Hill and how many accidents occurred as that. But that peak figure skews the accident data for that year, so it's really difficult to take what's a fairly low number and liable to vary year on year quite substantially and then extrapolate sort of trends from those. I think it's very, very unlikely that if we reduce the speed on roads we are going to increase the accidents. I've heard people tell me that they will be distracted by trying to drive at 20 miles an hour, and respectfully I'd suggest that if you can't drive a vehicle at the appropriate speed limit on the road, perhaps you shouldn't be driving a vehicle at all. We all adjust our speed to the appropriate speed limits. We all adjust them appropriate to the conditions. Within reason, there are a few people that will ignore speed limits and will constantly do it. But actually, I don't think that there is any evidence that suggests that accident data will show any increase as a result of slowing traffic down. The data suggests that severity of accidents is reduced.
Chris, are you against this in principle or just on certain roads?
The only place that I would say that it's a good idea, the only place, is outside schools. You know, I'm very happy there. Everywhere else, for me personally, you know, I'm 66, Andy. I'm sure you know that. And I've been driving since 1975, I think, or 76. I've never had an accident yet. I'm quite capable of driving at 30. I do not want to be driving at 20. So I'm really dead against it. And I think, personally, I think it's appalling. I mean, myself, Juan and Julian reported on the radio that we'd been to public meetings of Michelle's, and I went to one at Ramsey and they went to one at Douglas each, and none of us could find any member of the public that's wanting the 20 limits. So, you know, I'm really dead against it.
Okay.
And my personal thoughts are, you know, if they do drop it down to 20 and there's still accidents, there's only been 8 this year. Michelle did state that figures vary. Yes, they do vary from 2020 at 29, 23 at 27, and 24 at 21, and now this year down to 8 in 8 months. It's not a full year. So the trend is that it is dropping at the 30 limits. Why do we need 20? I think it's outrageous.
Okay.
And if Michelle goes against the public's decision, I think that's truly appalling as well. She's a public servant working for the public, not for herself.
Thank you, Chris. I think the thing to emphasise here is that we are out to consultation on this one. We have asked the public extensively, which roads do you support and which do you not? So your views about only supporting it around schools, that's fair enough, but there are lots of people in residential roads who say, yes, I want this for my street. And you can almost age our residential roads by those that are 20, because anything we've built in the last 25 to 30 years has automatically been a 20. There's been no question over it and there's been no pushback against it. Whereas the older estates tend to be, even though the roads are not any more suitable for driving at 30 miles an hour, tend to be 30 miles an hour because that's what the default was. What I'd like to say in terms of driving at reduced speeds, that if you're driving at 30 miles an hour, it'll take you 2 minutes to do a mile. If you're driving at 20 miles an hour, it'll take you 3 minutes to do a mile. It's an extra minute to do a mile. And we're not making mile-long 20 mile an hour zones. So the impact that it will have on your journey time is likely to be small. But until we've consulted and listened to all of those feedback and decided where the 20 miles an hour are appropriate and where there is community support, those schemes are not going in. They will go in due course when we've got all of that feedback analysed.
Okay, all right. Chris, we appreciate your call. Thanks for that. Got a note in from Ian, who just said, I think Michelle Haywood is doing a great job of stoically defending this, which is something that obviously her department has to do. And this was brought in, I mean, proposed by, I think, Mr. Shimmins years and years ago. Could you ask Michelle Haywood, if the slate were blank, would she actually start this herself now?
If the slate were blank, I suspect we would we would probably think that it was a sensible thing to do. So the previous caller, Chris, mentioned, you know, road safety is improving. There is a continuous review of road safety measures. So the Road Safety Partnership, working with the constabulary and with the department, constantly looks to see where there are accidents, where there are near misses. And remember that in those accident stats that Chris was quoting, that's just the accidents that get recorded. Yeah. They're just the ones that police get recorded. So you don't get somebody knocked my wing mirror off or somebody bumped into me, because if the police didn't need to be called, it doesn't figure in those stats. They're an underestimate. So we are continually looking at roads and looking how to improve the safety on roads. I suspect this would have come in the list. I don't think it would have come up as high as a priority had Tim Ward not made their decision. There would be other things like looking at young drivers, which we know are a particular risk, looking at our high-speed roads, particularly the mountain road, where we know that a large number of our fatalities are associated with high-speed crashes. And we'd be looking as well at older drivers, because we know that they are another group that's at risk. So I think there are other things in play in right. terms of looking at road safety. This is one of them. It probably wouldn't have been a high priority over and above the others, but it is still a priority to address.
Okay. And Ian just goes on and just said, if this comes into force, bearing in mind nobody's going to enforce it, you're relying on the good nature of the good drivers to do this, and there'll still be the rogue drivers who won't.
There will always be rogue drivers. So what data tells us is if you have a 30 mile an hour limit, there'll be those that most people will drive around 34 or 35-ish. We think that's acceptable. And there'll be some that drive over 40 because that's what their perception is of what the safe speed is. If you drop the speed limit to 20 in an area, the average driver will drop their speed down and they'll be driving around probably 24, 25-ish. But the people who are doing over 40, psychologically, then for them, that's twice the speed limit.
Right.
And that becomes a barrier. So what we see is those really high speed drivers who are ignoring speed limits anyway will tend to be pulled back down below the 30 mile an hour mark. And we know that the risks of serious injury if you're hit by a car at 20 or 30 miles an hour are considerably different. So it will bring down average speeds on roads, and we will get those faster drivers to slow down. And it's not true to say the police won't enforce it. They will enforce these like they enforce any other speed limits on the basis of risk and resource. What the department's committed to is once the 20 mile an hour signs are up and the zones are in place, that we will look then to re-engineer roads if necessary to force the traffic to slow down. And we've got examples of doing that up at St Mark's with the planters or in Port Sodric with the giveaways. And so there are a number of tweaks that we can make to road layout that will actually force traffic to slow down. But you're right, I'm kind of relying at the moment on the good drivers, the law-abiding people out there who'll see a 20 sign, who will understand that actually by doing that they're reducing the risk to other people, they're making the living environment for the residents more pleasant, and that they will slow down.
Okay. David's with us now. David, you're live with Michelle Haywood, MHK.
Hi, Randy. Hi, Minister. Two simple questions, really. There was a housing conference last week, and the rumours are circulating now that the five-year tenancies have been stopped. Can you confirm that? And then the other question is regarding housing and... As the minister, are you in law now, a landlord, or deemed to be a landlord in law? Yes or no?
Thank you, David, for the question. Are five-year tenancies being stopped? Absolutely not. Don't know where you've got that rumour. Probably best go back to the person who told you it and tell them that they're just talking nonsense. There is no plan for stopping five-year tenancies that I am currently aware of, and it certainly wasn't discussed at the housing conference, to the best of my knowledge, and I was there in the room for the vast majority of the day. Your second question?
It was regarding, as the DOI
is
responsible
for
public houses, as the Landlords Act came in and private landlords were subject to the law, is the DOI a landlord?
The DOI is a landlord. We obviously have properties that we have tenants in, and we manage those tenancies. So, yes, we are. Are we covered by the landlord registration? No, because as the law was framed at the time, it covers private landlords. It doesn't cover local authority, and it doesn't cover DOI housing. So it doesn't cover the public sector.
Okay, thanks, bye.
Okay, thanks for that point. Could you ask the Minister, this is a constituency one, so we'll put this in, views of tourism following the disturbing news of that young tourist stepping on a used needle at Port Erin. The government seems to have a lack of concern about the important tourism industry, the lack of intervention in controlling steam packet fares and what have you. But anyway, let's go to the point about the needle at Port Erin Beach.
I think it's a big leap to go from needles on Port Erin Beach. The government doesn't care about tourism. But parking that one, in terms of used needles, I heard the interviews this morning. I thought the visitor that had reported it was very measured in what he said. They are, you know, needles are quite prominent and becoming more commonly used, and it is I think we probably do need some sort of campaign about the responsible disposal. He is right that anyone who is using needles and has given a prescribed drug that requires the use of needles will be given a sharp spin. So I think we need to urge people to responsibly dispose them. I'm a little concerned as to how needles that are being used for insulin injections or for weight loss injections are ending up on a beach, to be fair, because that would not be the place that you'd necessarily anticipate people were sitting there injecting themselves. But all responsible regular users of such medication should know how to dispose of it safely. And I'd urge them, if they don't have a sharp spin, to pop into any of the local pharmacies and to ask for one, and they can pick one up there.
OK, thank you. 632, this is Alison, who just said, please pass the message on to Michelle Haywood. Many people, including myself, fully support 20-mile-per-hour zones, and thank you for the work. Anything which slows traffic down has my vote. The majority of drivers don't stick to speed limits, so all that will happen is that vehicles will drive at about 25 miles per hour, which is safer for everyone, says Alison. And 927 says, could you ask the Minister for the DOI, will the horse tramway be completed for the 150th year next July? What stage is the planning at? Is the tramway going to be over-engineered to fulfil the possibility of electric trams? Of course, that cost will go up. And it's allied to that, there was one in from Jane in Douglas who said, could you ask Michelle for an update on the completion of the horse tram track for the 150th anniversary? She spoke at the Ballycommeen Roadshow and said the money for it would have to be found and it couldn't be done in time. Now they've had an increase in tax receipts, could some of that be used to get it done?
Thank you. Thank both of the callers for their question. So the horse tramway business case is still within the department at the moment. We are still working on trying to get a coherent business case that supports that. I went down on a visit to the horse trams and to the electric trams a couple of weeks ago, and thanks very much to the guys around there for showing me around. It's an admirable service that they're kind of preserving, and I really, really value it. We are not likely to get any works completed for the 150th year. I hope that we've got to the point where we've got a business case and we've got the funding agreed, and that in the 150th year we can commit to supporting that the tramway going forward. The mention of electric trams running along the same rails, yep, has been, there is a section in the business case that deals with that. From memory, I don't think that it actually increased the cost by as much, right, as you would think. So it's possible that it's something that we can look at in there, because actually if you're going to do it, this would be the time to include it rather than going back. We're also, as part of that business case, looking at the future of Tramway Terrace and what we do with that, because we appreciate scaffolding's been up there for ages. The buildings are a bit of an eyesore, and we could do with dealing with the whole thing. So I'm kind of putting it all together. It's all about the horse tramway, and it's all about supporting that into the future. So we are working on it. Need to get it right before I bring it through Treasury and before I take it to Tim Ward. So we're just taking the time to get it right. I'm hoping that happens within the next few months, that we should have that forward.
Okay. The notion of electric trams, as you say, that's been swirling around for many years. And with the possibility of active travel and more public transport, if electric trams, modern electric trams, and bearing in mind that the permanent way that we have, the tracks that we have, are industry standard. They're not, it's only the rolling stock that's antique, and that's what they've done in Blackpool. If we did have electric trams, would the DOI run them?
The DOI runs pretty much all of our public transport. Okay. I know I've spoken to counterparts in the Channel Islands where they outsource their bus service. Yeah. Went out to procurement and have a private company running it, and their concerns were loss of control over timetabling, loss of control over the service, loss of political control over what was going on. I don't think there's any move here to talk about outsourcing any of that.
Right.
We have two distinct transport, although we try and run a coherent transport sector, we have two distinct, our buses are about our commuters and our visitors. visitors getting around the island to all parts of the island, whereas our heritage rail is really it's a visitor attraction. And I know that, you know, myself included, locals enjoy going on those attractions, but they're really there as the historical, you know, visitor attraction thing. There is a move to try and join things up as much as we can. I don't suppose there's not a lot of commuter traffic necessarily along the prom that would you know, stack up a good business case for investing in yet another variety of transport on the island, though.
Okay. We're with Michelle Hayward, DOI Minister on Man in Line. If you want to get in touch, by all means, text, email, call, WhatsApp.
Hi, Liz. I see you've had your garage converted. We're desperate for more room.
Yes. Come through and have a look. John called Manx Property Conversions. We now have an extra bedroom, but it could be another reception room, kids' playroom or office. They also did our conservatory roof last year. We were so impressed, we got them back to convert the garage.
Wow, I need that. What's their number again?
Call MPC on 450500. That's 450500. Or find them on Facebook at Manx Property Conversions.
Spectrum Windows. If your house needs a new look and your windows let in rain, keep those cold breezes out and make it look like new again. Spectrum Windows, Spectrum Windows. Quality through and through. Great work guaranteed to you. Spectrum Windows, Spectrum Windows.
Out and about this summer, EVF service stations have everything you need to make the most of it. Hot and cold food, chilled wine and beers, barbecue essentials and more. You can even pick up your lottery tickets at our stations across the island. Fill up, fuel up with Ellen Vannin Fuels. Visit us at evf.co.im. Stocks and offers may vary between locations.
Ramsey Garden Centre. For roses, shrubs, climbers, trees and perennials. Or solar lights, stone ornaments and bird baths. There's never been a better time to visit Ramsey Garden Centre. Open 7 days a week.
Radio Caroline North is back on the air this weekend for our annual three-day fundraiser. Thanks to your generosity so far, we've been able to expand our broadcast operations and prepare our ship, Ross Revenge, for that much-needed trip to dry dock. But there's still more work to be done, and we'll tell you how you can help us achieve it. So make a date this weekend. Our live broadcast starts on Friday at 10 on 1368 AM, on DAB and online. It's Radio Caroline North.
The Man in Line with Andy Wint.
And Michelle Hayward, MHK, DOI Minister, is here. Here's a note in from Alan, who just said, could you ask the Minister, the swing bridge in Ramsey has been closed to vehicles since the start of the year. Whilst it doesn't support huge volumes of traffic, it's important as a link to the north of Ramsey. It's only in the last few weeks that what would appear to be investigative works have started. No clear indication of when the bridge will reopen. Obviously, it's open to a foot traffic. In the meantime, what's known as the Stone Bridge by Bowering Road in the town is taking all the traffic north. Does the Minister have any information on the progress of the Ramsey Swing Bridge? Surely after 7 months and counting, this needs to be given some priority.
Thank you very much for the question. So the investigative works were completed quite a while ago. Because of the historic nature of the bridge and the historic structure of it, and because of its status, the team that looking at the repairs had to liaise through the relevant authorities to get permission to do the works on it. The deck is hardwood timber. It's relatively hard to source. However, I'm delighted to confirm that last week, that wasn't investigative works, that was the work starting. It's anticipated that the work should take 2 to 3 weeks, notwithstanding bad weather activities or us finding anything untoward when we're in there. I did myself go and visit it last week, possibly on Wednesday, and have a walk across and have a look at what was going on. And so the rotten timbers underneath have all been excavated out, and we're just at the process of fitting the new timbers and then fitting the new surface. So I am hopeful that that will be open sometime in the next couple of weeks, but obviously it'll be subject to all the engineering checks to make sure that it's safe to open to traffic.
They just wanted confirmation that it's definitely not going to be mothballed and it will happen.
No, absolutely, it's not going to be mothballed. It is one of those lovely structures, and some weird bits in my history. I'm quite interested in historic bridge structures generally. So it was one of the things I was quite keen to pick up with the team and check that they were on it and that all of the repairs are being done appropriately and that the bridge is being preserved for future use.
Okay, Julian's with us now. Hi, Julian. You're live with Michelle Hayward.
Hi, Andy, and hello, Michelle.
Hello, Julian.
Hiya. Your private members bill, the Safe Access Zones and Protected Public Places bill, what protected services is your bill addressing and what justification is there for its implementation?
So I think this has been well covered in the debates that I had in the House of Keys, and there is also the shorthand story that's up on the Tim Ward website, which links to all of those and links to the speaking notes and the debates that you can read through. There was quite a lot said about it. So in terms of services, it's designed to protect any medical or scientific service that is experiencing disruptive behaviour from people who object to lawful activity going on that site. It's designed to stop anyone from harassing any service users or service providers going into those sites, and there are a number of examples and I cited them in the House of Keys speech that I gave when I asked for permission to move the bill. There's a number of examples from around the island. They're not on a large scale. Some of them you wouldn't necessarily be aware of as a member of the public. However, in speaking to the Department of Health and Social Care, particularly social care, and in speaking to companies that do scientific research, and in speaking to medical services around the island, I'm aware that there are various issues that pop up from time to time, and this piece of legislation was purely to strengthen the protection for vulnerable people accessing legal services from being harassed or filmed or having their data published or anything that would cause them harm.
Right. See, I've got some grave concerns about your bill. The open-ended nature throughout the bill's clauses, for example, the inclusion within the list of your protected services of the words any other activity. Also, there's no upper limit to the duration or the size of these so-called access zones. You've got vague and subjective language used in the punitive clauses like influencing recklessly, either directly or indirectly, which could potentially criminalise anyone, especially considering you've written that the access zones locations will be anonymous. The only legal remedy to stop or reverse an access zone order being an expensive petition of doliance, which I would have thought would have created a two-tier system. Only the rich will be able to fight it with lawyers.
Okay, Michelle Haywood.
There's lots of questions in there, so before you get too far down the line, it was deliberately framed that we could put any other activity in so that, obviously, and if you've read through the bill, you'll know that this is the procedure. It would be the Department of Health and Social Care or the Department of Home Affairs, depending on which bit of the legislation you're looking at, that would have to agree to review an area and to decide to designate it as a safe access zone or to put a public space protection order in place. The reason for including any other activity is that it was future-proofing the bill against things that perhaps we can't foresee now that may cause problems in the future. But there are lots of checks and balances because the department has to agree with that and has to work up the scheme, and then it has to come through Tim Ward for approval. So there isn't just a we can write this and impose it on people. The size of the access zones is actually framed in a way that allows us to define it by distance, to define it by geographical feature, or to define it by a combination of those. And so it's not that it's limitless, because that would clearly be bonkers. It's designed to protect people who are accessing the service. So, for example, you may want to include the car park that goes next to a clinic, for example. You might decide that because there have been, I don't know, protests on the road outside with graphic images that were really causing an upset and intending to deter service users, that you would include the roadway outside in order to create that safe buffer zone. So it's deliberately framed, and the department does have to set out its reasons for where those safe access zones would be. There is the possibility that some of those safe access zones locations are not publicised in a normal way, because some of the locations are so sensitive, it would be reckless for us to publish the location and draw attention to it. So particularly I'm thinking of examples here within the social care setting where we have homes that may be things. Now, obviously, locally, that would be published, and I, you know, my hope would be that people respond in an appropriate way, that, you know, if you were warned by a policeman that this order was enforced for that area, you would know that information and you would respond accordingly rather than doing it. It's not intended that they all be anonymous, and so it's daft to claim that. It would almost be counterproductive, but there are some locations which are so sensitive.
Radio Caroline.
We shouldn't... Oh, Radio Caroline's coming in. There are some locations that are so sensitive that we shouldn't publish their locations, and so that's why that clause is there. So it will be a risk-based judgment by the department. And you're right, there are clauses in there about influencing people and trying to influence them. Now, just to give some context to this, I lived for a while in Ealing in West London, where the protest outside the Mary Stopes Clinic there led to something very similar being enacted in Ealing, and it was the first time that safe access zones around abortion facilities were put in place. And I saw on a daily basis how intimidating that was. And people can say to me, well, I've got the right to stand and pray silently anywhere. You do, but actually your presence can have an intimidating effect on people. And unless you put yourself in the position of a vulnerable service user, possibly accessing a very difficultly made decision to use a certain service, you have no idea just how your mere presence can affect that. And that is what we are trying to avoid. So there is a deliberate framing in there that allows those activities to be done. The current status of the bill is we went out for consultation, and I have published the consultation responses, and there are some clauses that we will be looking, I will be working to bring some amendments through to tighten up the language and to improve the language before I bring it back for third reading.
Okay, Julian?
Well, you mentioned abortion, but that's already covered under Dr. Allinson's private member's bill that became the Abortion Reform Act in 2019. So abortion's already covered under Access Zone. But I notice when you talk about sensitive, your new bill also includes the UK Animal Scientific Procedures Act. So are we going to see no-go zones around animal experimentation laboratories on the island? And by the way, we've got four major pieces of legislation on the island: Public Order Act, Protection from Harassment Act, Equality Act, and the Criminal Justice Act. And what about our human rights? You know, you're talking about, you know, outside in the roadway. We've got freedom of expression, we've got right of assembly and association, and freedom of movement. And from what I can see, just to summarise, all these factors that I've mentioned about your bill create a situation where potential misuse or overreach isn't just hypothetical, it's structurally enabled by the bill itself.
Okay, all right, we'll leave it there. Just a final word.
So the UK animal experimentation legislation is mentioned because that's how the island would authorise any of those. There is none of that going on the island, so don't please create any misconceptions out there that you know, we've got huge animal experimentation labs on the island. We don't have, and they are covered by legislation. I understand your human rights, but I also think that the rights of vulnerable service users trump your right to stand there and have your protest made. There are ways to make protests to against laws outside of Tim Ward, where the people who make the laws are. Don't protest where you're intimidating vulnerable service users.
Okay. Finally, Michelle Haywood, can you appreciate or empathise with people who suspect that there may be a propensity for overreach in this legislation?
I can see why some people have created that perception that there may be the possibility for overreach. I think the checks and balances in that it has to go through the department and be proposed by the department, and then it has to go to Tim Wald, and it has to be, you know, it can be challenged in Tim Wald, and that's the right place for those orders to be challenged and to be made. And obviously people will get the ability to lobby their MHK and to put their views forward at that point. So I can see why people are concerned about it. I genuinely don't think that this is going to be misused. I think that departments will use the legislation very carefully and only in those situations where it's the appropriate piece of legislation to use.
Okay, EVs now. What responsibility does the department have for enabling and installing electric charging stations for EVs? A visitor from the UK is visiting in his Tesla. Could the minister ask Tesla to install a supercharger on the Isle of Man? Tesla V4 SUVs are reliable, widespread and open to all EVs.
We wouldn't ask Tesla to do it necessarily. So I believe the legislation is such that supply of electricity has to come through the MUA. And so I think the department does support installation where we can, but I'm fairly sure that supply, because of the way our legislation framed, the only supplier of electricity is the MUA.
Who owns those charging points?
I think it depends on where they're located.
Right.
I know Ports and Merry Commissioners put some into their car park, but it's an MUA installation.
Right. And the one at the sea, there's a couple at the sea terminal, are they DOI?
I'm assuming they're probably DOI, but they would, you know, it does have to come via the MUA.
Okay, let's go to Stan now. Hi, Stan, you're live with the Minister from the Department of Infrastructure.
Hello there. I just wanted to ask you a question. Who owns the grass verges either side of the main road, you know, especially out in the countryside?
Okay. Why do you ask, Stan?
Well, it's getting a very common thing in the countryside because people are putting big stones and boulders around their gates, and if you hit them, who's liable? If it belongs to the highway board, are they liable, or the people that's put them there, are they liable if there's an accident?
Okay, there's a lot of that in the countryside, isn't there?
Thank you very much for the question, Stan. I think my advice is that if there are stones on the grass verge, probably don't drive on the grass verge. Try and stay on the road and try not to hit them, obviously. It depends on the location of the grass verges. Some of them are maintained by DOI because they're on major routes, and so we'll go out and cut those. Some of them are the landowner's responsibility to maintain and operate those. Yeah. And if it's your land, you can put stones wherever you like on your land.
Okay, I think the question is also, if there were an accident, if it was an accidental accident, instead of just going into a verge and they hit one of these enormous stones, who will be liable?
I guess it depends on the circumstances of the collision, and that would be, you know, that would be an insurance company discussion. But, you know, we have lots of dry stone walls alongside roads. If you hit a dry stone wall, you'll do a considerable amount of damage to your vehicle. But if you're not staying on the roadway, that's obviously a question about what was going on in terms of driving conditions and your ability to keep the car on the road.
Okay, Stan, you've not hit one, have you?
No, well, I did, but I didn't do much damage. But in the countryside, they're single-track roads. And if a car comes the other way, sometimes you end up back in half a mile because people's got these big stones out. It's, to me, it used to be the highway board owned from base of the hedge to base of the hedge. I don't know whether it's changed. Nobody's informed me. And I own property joining on the road, but nobody's informed me to say that I now own it.
All right. Now, that's an interesting point. So if it's a single-track road and there are properties along it and they, if you like, mow the verge and put these big stones to stop people going there, well, it's interesting as to who owns it then. Does the DOI own the verge?
Well, yeah, as I say, we'd have to go through land registry and we'd have to check for each of the locations as to where the land was registered to. I can see if you are somebody who lives down a single track road, you try and preserve those verges because having vehicles driving over them is going to lead to the grass being ripped off and erosion, and eventually you end up with muddy ditches at the side of the road, which is in nobody's interest. So, Stan, if there are any particular roads that you've got concerns on, can I urge you to go through the Highways Reporting Service and report them into Ellerslie, and we can get somebody down there to check on the roads and just check that everything's legal and above board.
What's the Highway Reporting Service?
So if you go through the DOI website and just look for report problem or notify.im, there's a whole thing. I think it might be inquiries. Is it inquiries at highways.gov.im? But don't quote me on that one. It's something similar to that as an email address. So you can drop in your complaints and everything to that. And that is the quickest way to get any highways issues onto the system so that they can be evaluated by our engineers and any response can be planned and prioritised.
OK, thank you for that, Stan. You can go, the Department of Infrastructure is at gov.im/infrastructure. Here's Scott now. Hello, Scott. You're live with Michelle Haywood.
Okay, right. I run DB Autos, the garage in Douglas, and over the last 10 or 15 years, we've seen massive problems with DPF units, which is, well, basically a catalytic converter for a diesel. It's not quite that, but that's the best way to describe it for people who don't know. And it's because of the short runs that we do on the island. Now, most of them are getting to about 50,000 miles and needing either replaced or cleaned and remapped. And that's the problem we've got at this speed. When cars are doing 20 miles an hour, these things are going to block up even faster, and they're going to cause more pollution and more emissions. So who has the government used to get the information on the emission side of things? Because it doesn't seem correct.
So I'll pick up on this. You're right, the island has really short runs, and unless you can take your vehicle and chuck it over the mountain on a regular basis, you're never going to get up to those kind of speeds that you need to regenerate the DPF. So that is, I mean, that's a feature anyway. But what we know from traffic speeds across Douglas and Onchan, particularly is that traffic speeds are not much greater than 20 miles an hour for most of the time. So those existing problems or that existing constraints will carry on irrespective of whether the roads stay badged at 30 miles an hour or say at 20 miles an hour. So you'll see the same issues continuing. I don't necessarily know that we'll see an acceleration of that because people are not driving at 20 miles an hour through the centre of Douglas now. The average speed on Victoria Street is just under 9 miles an hour during the sort of the peak times and rush hour times, and so people are doing lots of very short journeys, and it is something for car owners to consider when they're choosing their vehicles.
Scott? Okay, I actually live and I work on Victoria Road, and I'd say the average speed on that road's about 40 miles an hour.
Well, that's Victoria Road, not Victoria Street.
Yeah, Victoria. I'm just saying, I'm using it as an example.
Okay.
So
yeah.
People, you know, I don't see, I've tried driving around at 20 miles an hour quite a lot lately, and it just doesn't work. You're not moving, you're taking too long to get there, people behind are beeping at you. What I'd also like Mrs. Haywood to answer is, she's very prominent on Facebook, as are a lot of people these days. Surely she can see the amount of negativity on every single post about these 20 mile an hour speed limits.
Okay, so with response to Victoria Road, that was one that came up quite a lot in the drop-in sessions that we ran, and I'm sure it's there represented in the consultation. I think there's almost sort of three phases to Victoria Road, depending on where you are as to what the appropriate speed might be. I take it, you know, your evidence that says the average speed up there is 40 miles an hour. If that's the average, I'm worried about what the top speeds up there might be. Certainly down the lower end as you come to where the old Wainwright used to be and you're coming to towards the villa, the speeds there should be much slower. And I suspect when we've done the re-evaluation of the consultation responses for that road, that there might be some differential coming in along there. With regards to Facebook, you're right, I do try and comment, I do try and go in and correct inaccuracies, I do try and provide factual information so that people are debating the actual information rather than supposition or made up stuff that quite often presents itself on there. You are right that there are a number of negative comments, and I do see those, and I do take notice of those. However, I'm also aware of a lot of people within my own constituency and outside of that who come up to me and say, I'm not commenting on Facebook because if I do, somebody will jump on me and there will be a whole pile on and they'll all tell me I'm wrong and they'll all be aggressive and nasty, so I'm not commenting. So my considered opinion of Facebook is, it is one source of public opinion, it is not the reference point of public opinion. I think there is much better data to be got from the consultation that we ran, and there is much better data to be got from going out and talking to people within my constituency and across the island. And I've been going around and doing a number of visits to local authorities. I'm also doing a drop-in session up in Ramsey on Saturday morning from 10 till 12 at the town hall for the 20 mile an hour consultation for up the northern end of the island. So I think there are much more balanced conversations that happen outside of Facebook, and Facebook has become its own little echo chamber. So you're right, there's a very negative opinion of me, often from people who don't know me, don't know my motivations and don't understand all of the facts about the situation. And I read it, I take it on the chin, but I don't
Sorry to butt in, I didn't say the negativity about you. I said the negativity about the 20 mile an hour speed limit. I live in Onchan, and I know a lot of people. I've not met one person who wants this to happen. So wherever you're getting your data from, maybe you should look at getting a different source, because when you speak to people on the ground, I haven't met one person who wants this to happen yet. So
okay.
I don't believe it, I'm afraid.
Okay, all right. Well, we appreciate that, Scott. And thanks for having your say today. Just going back to Facebook and going back to criticism, Michelle Haywood, do you take stuff personally?
I think you'd have to be insane not to take some of it personally. You'd have to be so arrogant and divorced from reality not to read some of that stuff. Some of the stuff is truly awful.
Yeah.
And, you know, if that discourages good people from stepping forward to put themselves forward for election and to go into public service, I'd be really upset about that, because I can see how detrimental it can be. It's you know, for me personally, my three sons are all over 18 now, and they're all grown up. But I would hate it for them to be in school and for some of the things that have been said about me to be circulating around. They're all wise enough to not take it to heart. But it's really difficult stuff that's written sometimes. People with no grounding in facts or anything who really don't know me at all.
OK. We live in Ramsey, says John, and are in support of Michelle's 20-mile-per-hour speed limit. Pedestrians, I think, will feel safer. A note in from Andy who just said, could you ask the minister, has the department considered inviting an electric bicycle hire company like Santander Bicycles to operate in and from Douglas?
Electric bikes and electric scooters are actually on my big whiteboard of to-do things. I'm working, you'll have noticed since I came in as minister, I've kind of been working away trying to sort of like chip some of the stuff that I know is on the DOI's list of things to address. It's an interesting suggestion and I'm happy to take it on board. It will be one of the things that I'm trying to find time to look at and to evaluate.
Try to find... I mean, your department is absolutely huge. I mean, there's probably only Claire Christian, who's probably got more on her in-tray than you have. Highways, airports, harbours, quarries, planning, building control, meat plant, animal waste, public transport, things like the MEA, the Sewerage Authority, Planning Authority, Health and Safety, Road Transport Licensing Committee.
Haven't got planning, and I haven't got the meat plant. They're DEFA.
Oh, are they DEFA now?
They're DEFA, yeah.
Do the meat plant report to...
Yeah, meat plants are DEFA.
Right, OK.
DEFA
so
issue at the moment.
How do you allocate resources and your personal time to this? Is it just on an as and when basis, or do you proactively go to look for something?
I've got a list of things, so when things are raised by either MHKs or fellow Timwell members or constituents, I've got a rolling list of things that I contact officers with. We have regular department meetings, we have regular policy and strategy meetings. The officers since I've joined the department have been fantastic, because every time I need to get up to speed on the next topic that's coming up, they run a briefing for me, and they're always really responsive to give me the information that I need. So in terms of priorities, we've obviously got priorities that are set in the island plan. We've got Timwell commitments as well, and we track those, and we're working through those. But you're right, the department is so huge, and I suspect we are the department that touches everyone's lives every single day at a number of touch points. And we don't always get it right, and it would be, you know, stupid me to claim, but actually we do get it right a lot of the time. So if you drove into the radio station today on the roads and your journey was smooth and everything, that's because, you know, we've done the work on repairing roads and stuff like that. And we get some pushback about things like the mountain road being closed. We're closing roads off because we need to work on them. And we have to find the time to do that work to make sure that that road surface is safer and it's there for everyone to use going forwards.
OK, we're almost out of time. I just want to remind you that Summerland 50 Remembering for the Future exhibition is on until the 9th of August. It's a week-long commemorative exhibition exploring the years before, during and after the fire of the 2nd of August 1973. It's at the Villa Marina Arcade, and it's been organised by Summerland Memorial Limited.
Fed up sifting through applications and hitting dead ends? We get it. It's not the high-flying life a boss should have. So step away from the desk, make a coffee, and let us take the reins. Orchard Recruitment adds a refreshing change to your hiring process. Getting to know your business and culture before finding you the right people. We won't send you any old CV. We'll cherry pick. Make your next onboarding fruitful. Visit orchardrecruitment.com.
Welcome to the Millichaps of Ramsey Summer Sale, where you'll find fabulous reductions throughout the store, from beds and flooring to sofas, cane furniture and accessories, rugs, pictures, mirrors and even wallpapers. Plus, the friendly Millichaps team are here as always with a warm welcome and expert help and advice when needed. Don't miss the Millichaps of Ramsey Summer Sale, now on.
Creating a home where you'll love to be. Millichaps of Ramsey.
Now's the time to make the most of the outdoors, so head to Riley's Garden Centre. Whether you're planting, pruning or just relaxing in the sun, Riley's has everything you need. From garden machinery to tools and compost to outdoor furniture, barbecues and more. Transform your garden into your paradise with a little help from Riley's. Open 7 days a week on Cool Road, Braddon, or browse online at rileys.co.im. Riley's Garden Centre, everything for the great outdoors.
The Man in Line with Andy Wint.
And the DOI Minister, Michelle Haywood, is with us. We're almost out of time. Just a quick one regarding road surfacing, resurfacing. Is it true this is a company from across that's doing it? What's the name of the company that's doing it?
Keely's.
Keely's, OK. Do their staff, this is a question from Andrea, do their staff require work permits?
So I'm not entirely sure about the work permit question. Keely's are in the middle of a 5-year contract. The department went out for a contract to do summer works and to do a considerable number of micro-surfacing and planing jobs and everything that we just don't have the men or the machinery to manage to achieve that level of work. So we have a summer works programme. This is the third year of it, as far as I'm aware. And Keely's do come over and I'll apologise to the lady in Colby who messaged me the other morning to say, why are the DOI sweeping my road on a Sunday morning at 7:30? And that's because Keely's were arriving at 8 o'clock to resurface a road. They work incredibly hard and they work lots of hours across that time to try and achieve the targets that we've set for them.
Okay, so it's a 5-year contract. How far are they through it?
I think they're 3 years and this is the third year of the contract, so another 2 years to run yet. And it forms part of the summer plans for the department on how to achieve as best we can for the roads on the island.
Okay, and that's and of course it was obviously prior to you that they were awarded the contract, and that's purely because we got rid of all the direct labour and the plant years and years ago.
The department has been getting smaller over the years, there's no denying that, but we are working really, really hard to work A, within our budgets, and B, achieve as much as we can for the money. We're trying to be really, really efficient about what we do.
Okay, lots of people have asked this, so I'll put it to you, and we are 14 months away from the next election.
Mm-hmm.
And they are saying, Michelle Haywood, will you be standing in Russian September next year?
That is my anticipation at the moment. I intend to stand again, yes.
Okay. Thanks for popping back, by the way, so soon after the last one. Would you pop back again soon in the future?
Andy, it would be a delight to come back again and see you.
Thanks for being with us today. Good to hear from you. That's been Michelle Haywood, MHK, Department of Infrastructure Minister. On Thursday, the Treasury Minister's on. Dr. Allenson will be on. If you want to get a question in, normal routes, email maninline@manxradio.com or the answer phone on 682631. Friday, we're going to be live at the Royal Show with a panel of guests talking about agribusiness, agriculture, finance, ecology, the whole bit. And next Monday, Claire Christian, MHK, the DHSC Minister, will be live on Man in Line. But for today, thanks to Chris on the phones. Thanks to Michelle Haywood for being with us. And thanks to you for being involved in Man in Line. Enjoy the rest of your Tuesday.
WINT.